morning. We welcome you to our first sitting in the oral arguments in April. And we have some special guests. We have students from Mount Horeb High School. Would they please stand? Good to have you here. You may be seated. These students are here with a long-standing program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. It's a national award-winning program. Students around the state are invited to come to the court, listen to an oral argument, and at the lunch hour, meet with a justice assigned to meet with the students. The students and the justice discuss the procedures of the court and how we take cases, decide cases, and issue opinions. There is no discussion of the substantive legal issues of the cases we hear. Everyone is invited to that discussion. It's not limited to the students. And suggest you do that. Now, is there anyone here who does not have a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you'd raise your hand, we'll give you a summary. It's easier to listen to oral argument if you know something about the facts and the legal issue. Anyone else? If not, let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. You will meet with Justice Bradley at noon today or after the second oral argument. Seated to Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Protzer, and seated on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our first case, which is 2013 AP 1437 CR, State v. Shatta. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Nancy Nowak. And there will be 10 minutes of argument of the amicus, Stacey Teuber, and then 30 minutes of argument of on behalf of the defendant appellant, Adam Shatta, by Amelia L. Bizarro, and then counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay? All right. We'll start with the Assistant Attorney General.
Good morning. This will be the Wisconsin Supreme Court's first opportunity to decide what the United States Supreme Court's decision in Padilla versus Kentucky will mean. Specifically, what will we require of criminal defense attorneys in terms of their obligation to advise non-citizen clients regarding the immigration consequences of their pleas?
Can you raise the podium?
The point is
I
to...
I think on your left side, it'll raise
right
the whole
side.
Thing up. There's a button. The trick question.
The point is to make get your voice louder so we can hear you better.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry. I don't often struggle, but I can speak loudly, and sometimes it's too much, but I'm happy to accommodate that.
That's good. Thank you.
You're welcome. And so that is the question. What will we require of criminal defense attorneys in terms of advising their clients about the immigration consequences of their pleas? This does require us to peer into what I will describe as the rabbit hole that is immigration law in this country. But opposing counsel in both this case and its companion case, if you will, that will follow immediately after this one, is inviting the court to jump into that rabbit hole. And more important, asking the court to cloister criminal defense attorneys in that rabbit hole. They ask too much. The phrase automatic deportation comes up a lot. There's no such thing. Criminal defendants who want to know whether they're going to be automatically deported are asking to know the unknowable. Much like sentencing, which I think is the closest analogy to the situation we have in terms of advice about immigration consequences. Defendants are told what if any minimum penalties apply, and they are advised of the maximum. And then, depending on a defense attorney's experience, either with similar pleas on similar crimes, with the specific judge who may be presiding at the sentencing hearing, the attorney may say anything from, I don't know what the judge will do in this case. I haven't had a lot of experience here. Or may say, based on the facts or what he or she knows about the judge presiding.
I'd like to take you down a particular off-ramp of the rabbit hole, if I may. And that is, I'd like to start with Padilla itself.
Sure.
Are you of the opinion that Padilla is internally inconsistent, that there are seem to be inconsistent conclusions that are set forward in Padilla?
I don't know if you had anything specific in mind, Justice Gableman. I think Padilla, in an effort to be simple, is of course subject to interpretation.
Well, what I mean is fairly simple, and it goes to the heart of this. You use the phrase automatic deportation, which is used in the bookends of Padilla, or something like that. But in between, Padilla discusses, Justice Stevens discusses the potential, the possibility, the strong probability. That's what I mean.
In that respect, I agree with you entirely. I think the use of the phrase automatic deportation in Padilla is not just dicta. I think it's dead-bang wrong. I think it's an extraordinarily poor choice of language.
You, at the beginning, you didn't have to sell me on the idea that you can speak loudly.
I wouldn't think so.
I have one more question I have to ask about the separate branch of the rabbit hole, which is the code itself, the United States Code on Point. Now, it starts out by, at first blush, it starts out by appearing as if it is akin to automatic. But in the middle of the pertinent section of the stat of the code, I notice the phrase, upon the order of the Attorney General. Now, I wonder to myself, as I read that, I think we've all read newspaper articles, we've all seen it on various news reports, that the current administration in Washington, D.C. has taken a strong policy against deportation, and that deportations are not occurring, and when they do, they are relatively rare. I don't know if that's true, because we're all in this, and I like your phrase, we're all in this sort of quagmire or rabbit hole that is immigration law. And I wonder to myself, what if the Attorney General of the United States decides to just let these things for his or her signature, let these orders stack up somewhere? Is there a writ of mandamus to be filed? Is there any way to force the Attorney General to act? Because at least what I read through the media, to the extent you can rely on that, is that those orders are not being signed.
Well, I don't want to stray too far, and the rabbit hole, by the way, has many branches, and they change almost constantly. I don't know the specifics of what reports you might be referencing. They may be speaking not just to an immigration prosecution, if you will, for, let's say, deportation. They might speak to certain forms of discretionary relief, which, by the way, is not at issue in this case.
Right, exactly. But I'm saying, even when the code appears to be mandatory, it has, you know what I'm talking about, right? In the middle of this, it's upon the order of the Attorney General. My question is, what happens if the Attorney General decides not to sign them or to designate anybody to sign them?
Or if an individual prosecutor decides not to pursue a case. These things happen. They absolutely do.
Okay.
And I think you're getting into the area where I said defendants who are non-citizens want to know the unknowable. They don't know if a prosecutor will exercise discretion and not pursue action. They don't know if the Attorney General will allow discretionary relief or not. There are circumstances when it is allowable or not. Sometimes that happens. But it's you can't know. That's part of the problem here.
Even in the code on point here about the drug trafficking, where on the one hand it appears to have a strong, if an alien commits one of the following offenses, which is at issue here, then deportation will occur. But in the middle is that phrase, upon the order of the Attorney General.
And let's not forget that the statute says they are deportable. It does not say they shall be deported.
Padilla did something about that, which goes back to the possibility of inconsistencies in Padilla.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Okay. And then leaves the... I'm sorry, Justice Bradley, you had a question.
I heard you in response to Justice Gableman's question assert that discretionary relief is not possible here. Is that what I heard you say?
I don't know that. That's a very interesting question. By the way...
What did you say then? Maybe I didn't hear you correctly.
Discretionary relief might be available to Mr. Shada. I know that in drafting the amicus brief here, and here's where we get into the rabbit hole, but I think I'll go there just a little bit to make the point about how and why we don't want criminal defense attorneys to have to do it.
Let me, if I may.
Sure.
All I wanted to do is to get clarification on what I heard, I thought I heard. So it's not your position that discretionary relief is not possible here. Did I misunderstand?
I would not say, I don't think you can say definitively that it is not possible in this case. And, again, it requires a little bit of a trip down the rabbit hole to explain why I have to take that position. I don't know if the court really wants to do that, but I think it may make a point about how difficult these analyses become.
Well, you point to the brief, the amicus brief,
yeah,
that indicates that there is no possibility for discretionary relief here, that there are two avenues for non-discretionary relief, only one which comes into play in this case, the Convention Against Torture, which really isn't applicable. That's what as I read the amicus brief, to say that there is no discretionary relief here. That seems to be consistent with the interpretation of Justice Stevens in the majority opinion that the statute in question, and he says, the majority opinion says, and I quote, commands deportation, unquote.
Well, and I think the amicus takes the viewpoint that this would be, there would be no possibility of discretionary relief because they interpret two cases, Descamps versus United States. I apologize for my pronunciation. I am certain it's going to be very poor with a number of names today. I'll make my best effort. And that's at 133 Supreme Court 2276, and Moncrief. They came out within months of each other. Moncrief is 133 Supreme Court, 1678.
Before I get to you attacking whoever, I don't mean attacking, I mean addressing. I want to focus on Justice Stevens' interpretation of the federal statute at issue in both Padilla and here, and whether or not his interpretation that the federal statute commands deportation is a correct interpretation.
Commands deportation. I think that's another extraordinarily poor choice of words. There's no such thing as automatic deportation.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, in circumstances such as we have here with Mr. Shada, say there's a strong chance? Sure.
Would you be more comfortable with... So you disagree with the majority's majority's interpretation of the federal statute at hand?
I think they used some poor language in Padilla, including automatic deportation and what you were discussing there, no possibility of discretionary relief. I think they got some of that stuff wrong, absolutely. Elsewhere in the opinion, the phrase automatic deportation, by the way, is dicta in addition to being wrong.
Yeah, but when they
speak of eligibility.
When they were in the paragraph interpreting the statute, they set forth the federal statute, and then they interpreted it. and said it commands deportation. That was right after that. You just disagree with that.
The language of the statute is that the offenses listed make someone deportable.
Mm-hmm. I read that.
On its
too.
Language alone. I don't think the statute commands deportation.
I agree with you that on language alone it is deportable. But then when I look at the majority's definition, interpretation of that statute, and it says it commands deportation, I say to myself, well, I may have read it differently. Am I really bound by their interpretation of that statute?
But I would ask again, what does command deportation mean? There are defendants who, convicted of offenses that make them deportable, are not deported. Mm-hmm. It happens. So if the statute commands deportation, shouldn't that happen automatically? It doesn't.
The statute that we're referring to is the statute we're talking about here, the illicit drug.
Understood.
Statute, yeah.
And that's where I was getting into the rabbit hole with Descamps and Moncrief. The amicus takes the position that no discretionary relief would be available because the offense at issue in this case would automatically be deemed an aggravated felony. I read Descamps and Moncrief quite differently.
Counsel, I'm going to ask Justice Bradley's question, I think, in a different way. And it's this. Isn't this case factually on all fours with Padilla?
With Padilla?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
In Padilla received affirmatively wrong advice. His attorney told
him
he would not be deported.
I said factually. I meant it. Factually, it's a sale of drugs, right? Marijuana, and it's not under the exception of solely for your own use.
No,
right?
But okay. There is some issue there. This is a situation in which Mr. Shana passed off an amount of marijuana. We'll call it a brick for lack of better description. He passed it off to someone else who I think then delivered it to a police officer. There's no suggestion he received remuneration. He was a middleman. I believe that's a summary of what happened.
So you think that's a distinction factually between this and Padilla?
It could be.
Okay. Well, then what I'm trying to get at is then let's just, for my peace of mind, say that they are very, very similar, and therefore the statute is interpreted by Stevens, which is a federal statute, and he has a right to interpret it. That it commands, or it's, if it's not a sure thing that he's deported or deportable, it's as close as you're going to come in the statute. I mean, that's my rough interpretation. Okay, so what's different between Padilla and this? What was said in Padilla to advise the defendant? And what was said here?
I'm trying to recall specifically what the advice was in Padilla. I have the decision right here.
Because your concept
I think the problem there, Justice Abrahamson, is this. In Padilla, and I blipped on this for a moment, but in Padilla, the defense attorney said, you will not be deported.
Okay.
In this case, the defense attorney said, there's a strong chance you will be deported.
Okay. So there was misadvice, but
yes.
You read Padilla as saying that that's a misadvice case because Justice Alito's concurring opinion talks about misadvising and distinguishes misadvising from failing to give them advice. Well, you know, failing to give advice or giving advice slips into misadvice, and Alito would have concurred in the judgment because he thought it was misleading. But that wasn't a Stevens' opinion that it was misadvising. It was he was entitled to get advice that was correct as to the deportation consequences. So what is your test? You're not happy with Padilla, but we're bound by Padilla, right?
Oh, I understand.
You're bound by it, too. So what's the test that you draw from Padilla that should be used in the state of Wisconsin? And then the second part of my question is, we have a statute where the judge has to advise on penalty of retrial, has to advise the defendant that if you're not a citizen, then what happens today can be important to you. I'm paraphrasing it, but essentially important to you in deportation, reentry, et cetera, in immigration, right?
Yes.
Is the statute enough? If you give the advice of the statute, does that fit the idea?
You have an interesting point. So if I can take the second part of your question first. I have notes about this. 97108 sub 2 does, in fact, require the circuit court to advise defendants that they may be subject to certain immigration action. And now we're talking about potentially if opposing counsel takes the day.
But does it fit under Padilla? Is it good enough under Padilla?
Not if Padilla means that that defense attorneys have to give specific and absolute and unequivocal advice.
So the answer is no, and it wouldn't have been okay under Padilla. All right. So it's a good start.
Depending on what Padilla means, and I think that's up in the air. And Padilla's...
Well, you tell us what the state wants Padilla to mean.
I knew you'd ask for a standard.
Right.
And I thought about this long and hard, and I talked with a lot of people about this. And I think to try to come up with a black-letter standard for these cases jumps right down the rabbit hole. And I strongly encourage this court not to do that. I don't think you can, under the veil of a black-letter standard, cover everything.
Why isn't it enough, the warnings that trial court judges give across the state, as I did for 6 years, every time they fled to one of these offenses? You have to say to everyone, no matter if you know the person was born and grew up in the county that you're serving, do you understand, it's been a while, do you understand that by entering into your plea here today, that your plea may lead to your deportation, exclusion, or refusal of readmittance into this country, which many times would lead to a very puzzled and concerned conference between defendant and defense counsel, but it happens to be true. It may lead to such results. Why isn't that a good black letter? It seems to me the courts have been following it for almost a decade.
No, understood. And I think in many respects, and so I suppose if I were to suggest a standard, it would be something akin to sentencing. That's your maximum possibility. You could happen. Padilla is fairly interpreted, I think, to require a bit more than the court's obligation, but I'm standing here today asking not to go too far. Don't go down that rabbit hole.
Padilla seems to require don't give your client wrong advice.
True. But also does say when the, for instance, this is a quote from
when the
Padilla,
potential is clear, so equal is
clear,
the duty.
Which I submit is almost never the case. The duty to give correct advice is equally clear.
Right.
Correct advice is not you will automatically be deported because there is no such thing. And if we require defense attorneys to use that kind of magic language, one, it's wrong. Because what happens when a criminal defense attorney tells his client, okay, well, I'll use Padilla's language and as might be suggested by opposing counsel, and I'll tell everyone you're automatically going to be deported. What happens when they're wrong? Don't we have a problem there, too? And if the standard is too high for criminal defense attorneys, everyone loses. As a prosecutor, I won't extend plea agreements to non-citizen defendants that I should for every other reason that's reasonable and appropriate, because I fear losing the conviction, because I know that based on the standard or an interpretation of Padilla, the standard is too high for the criminal defense bar to meet. I won't take that risk. I'll try the case and get a conviction that is not in jeopardy. Defendants lose the benefit of plea bargains they might otherwise get simply for that reason. We can't make the standard too high, and we can't have magic words that defense attorneys are required to use. We have Strickland, and we have Padilla, and we have to decide what Padilla means in that context. But I think we have to stick with a Strickland analysis. These cases are all very different. They're all based on an individual defendant's status, how long he or she has been here, the crime at issue, the analysis of that. That's the rabbit hole.
Does Strickland ultimately point to a standard, and I know the ABA, and it's cited in the briefs, references this, a standard with regard to performance of attorneys, of reasonableness given the professional norms. Is that essentially what Strickland ends up doing? Reasonableness under the, you know, professional norms.
Yes, essentially, I think that's it in a nutshell, and that's what should and I think does govern these cases.
I want to just take a moment to get to prejudice.
Okay.
Some might advance that, look, there's strong evidence here against the defendant, so why do we even deal with this case? It's impossible for the defendant here to show prejudice in this context. You address that a bit in your brief, and then you go on also to talk about remanding the case. So if you can address the issue of prejudice, I would appreciate.
I think, and this gets back, the Court of Appeals decision in Mendez was a similar circumstance. Frankly, the record is not fantastic on the prejudice prong, because I think the trial court went with its finding, as it's permitted to do under Strickland, on deficient performance. And because the court found there was no deficient performance, I mean, there was a small discussion of prejudice. But the record is not complete on that point. Mr. Shada submitted incomplete information from his detainer about the bases for his immigration action. There may well be additional bases for his deportation.
And in fact, you point out that only one of three pages was submitted.
That's right, and it happens all the time in these cases.
So what's your position with regard to the prejudice analysis here? Should we be remanding if we would find deficient performance?
If the court finds deficient performance, yes. I think it goes back for a hearing on prejudice, and the court gets a chance to complete the record and find out if Mr. Shada is deportable separately and completely apart from this case. Oftentimes, that is the case. Many of these defendants are here illegally and are deportable for that reason alone. It has nothing to do with the criminal case. The criminal case may garner a referral. And it's often when defendants are taken into custody and based on the biographical information they give to law enforcement and other reasons that those referrals are made and the investigations take place. But they are often separately deportable well before that.
I'd like to ask you about that. I'm looking at page 22.
Abrahamson, I just want to say my red light is on. I just want to make sure I make that clear.
I'm allowed.
I understand, but I was asked to point that out to the court, and so I
thank you.
Wanted to do that.
It says on page 22 that based on the record, the court should reverse the Court of Appeals decision and determine that the defense counsel's performance was not deficient and that Shada failed to demonstrate prejudice. If you win on either one of those, then it's fine, right? It's or, right?
Yes.
All right. This sentence says, in the alternative, the court should reverse and remand the case to the circuit court for an additional evidentiary hearing and related determination. And my question is, what is that hearing on? I read it to mean prejudice, because that wasn't in the briefs or in the record as I understand it.
That's correct.
But you said in that it would go back to also determine more about the immigration law in response to that question. At least that's what I heard. So what does it go back for if the court should choose that alternative?
If this court decides there was deficient performance, right, the case should go back for an evidentiary hearing on prejudice. If I stated it differently, I misspoke.
I just want you to know I read it that way, and I...
Yes.
Okay.
Ms. Noah, when you have the opportunity for rebuttal, I would like you to address the question in Padilla, or the Justice Stevens' conclusion, the court's conclusion, that a defendant's rational decision to enter a plea will not by itself serve as a basis for prejudice, and also... My understanding is, my recollection is, there was a hearing here, and the trial court made findings based at least in part on what the defense counsel told the trial court in regard to the potential for defenses in this matter.
Thank you, counsel. We're now going to hear from Ms. Teuber, representing the amicus.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stacey Teuber. I direct the Immigrant Justice Clinic.
Move that microphone closer to you.
How is that? Is that better?
Yes.
Center.
Yes. I direct the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and I appear today as amicus curiae on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Hatem Shatta. I only have 10 minutes, so I guess I can try to talk really fast. but I think that maybe the first thing I should do is try to help us address this rabbit hole issue. I don't think it's a rabbit hole. I think it's, as immigration may be a complicated area of law, but it's certainly not something that is unknowable.
Counsel, I'm still having a little trouble hearing you, so belt it out here.
Okay.
It may also mean you're going to have to speak more slowly.
Okay.
Can you address my question to Ms. Nowak, which is the meaning of the phrase that is in the center of the relevant United States Code section upon the order of the Attorney General. If the Attorney General, for whatever reason, policy related or otherwise, makes a decision and to not sign such orders, what provision is there to make that happen?
Well, I think that's what I'd have to see the specific statutory thing you're referring to, but I think that
haven't seen the statute.
Well, no, what the Immigration Act delegates authority, often when it says the Attorney General, that authority is delegated to immigration judges. So it'll say under authority of the Attorney General, and that authority is affected through immigration judges. So, in fact, an immigration judge does not have discretion in a case such as Mr. Shatta's.
When you say that, are you saying that an immigration judge, when a petition to deport is filed by the prosecutor, just simply takes it on? Nothing has to be done in regard to the Attorney General either before or after the judge's decision for deportation to occur?
Correct. So the immigration judge will issue an order that says, I find the respondent removable as charged, signs the order. That gets handed over to ICE, and the person is deported. That's the end of the story.
Okay, so there's no order of the Attorney General that enters into that process at all?
No.
Well, the code I'm referring to, I'm confused. The code is 8 United States Code, Section 1227, Sub A, which recites in relevant part, quote, any alien in and admitted to the United States, now we have shall, but then we have upon the order of the Attorney General, be removed if the alien is within one or more of the following classes of deportable aliens, which I think everybody acknowledges Mr. Shadda was. So
correct.
I'm trying to get at what the meaning of that phrase, upon the order of the AG.
So what that means is, as delegated to the immigration courts, that's the procedure that goes.
How do I get from the language of the code to what you just told me?
I don't have a cite for you on that.
Okay.
But I can tell you that whether it's in the statute or regs, the Attorney General delegates, and I would guess it's similar in other administrative agencies, right? There's a lot of authority that's the agency is created and authority is delegated to effectuate the statutes.
How many immigration cases that includes? Deportation, if you talk about removal, failing to enter, a month, a year, or whatever.
I'm sorry?
How many are there in a year or in a month or whatever?
How many immigration cases?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's thousands, so
that's my point.
Right.
And the AG does not give an order on each one of them, right?
Right, of course. I mean, that would be absolutely impossible.
But if the AG can delegate, the AG, it seems to me, can undelegate and say, I am no longer delegating to anyone the authority, my authority, as Attorney General, to deport. That's what I'm hearing.
And I think that's the same as saying the U.S. Attorney General could simply say, I order you to stop prosecuting all crimes.
Right.
And I don't think you
can
do that.
Well, or certain classes of crimes, like I just read about yesterday in another city that's out.
Right. Right. And I think that's what the administration has done. The administration, I mean, there is always prosecutorial discretion. That's a given. But that lies with the prosecutor, whether to bring a charge or not. And so the Obama administration has said, we're going to focus the resources that we have on criminal cases, criminal immigration cases. So, in fact, almost anyone with a criminal conviction is not going to get a break under any of these new policies or executive orders or anything. In fact, I would say enforcement has increased, and we all know, I think, that the administration has, in fact, deported. And it's in the millions of people.
Where is that policy set down somewhere that we can look at it?
Yes.
Where?
There are several memos that lay out very specifically when ICE officers are to exercise discretion. And there's a list of priorities. There's a list of.
So we have the ICE officers who can exercise discretion. We have immigration judges who may have delegable or delegated authority, and we have an attorney general who may order certain deportations and order the refrain from certain deportations, and we have the president, of course, who sets the policy for all.
There is some discretion at each of those levels, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Just as there is in any other proceeding.
When he's seeking to withdraw his plea under 970.108 sub 2, it requires the court to make certain considerations. If the court fails to advise the defendant as required, which is the May language that was referenced earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the court has to go further. It's not just, oh, I forgot to give you the warning. And so you get to withdraw your plea. It's much more complex than that, I think, or at least when I had these in court, I thought it was more complex than that. Because if you look at the language of the statute, if the court blows it and the court doesn't give the warning, then the defendant has the burden to show that the plea is likely to result in deportation, exclusion from admission, denial of naturalization. And the court then, on the defendant's motion, so long as the defendant makes that showing, would then allow the plea to be withdrawn.
Mm-hmm.
here, the showing is the DHS detainer, right? Is that?
Well, I think, I mean, I think we're conflating the two cases. So
I'm trying to get, if the court has, a court has certain obligations. The court has to say, if you're not a citizen, et cetera, I need to advise you that this could result.
Right.
It may result, may is the word, result in deportation. If I, as a judge, blow it, and I don't even give that warning, first off, they show that I didn't give that warning. Let's just say we have the transcript. Mm-hmm. And then it's not so fast. He doesn't get to withdraw his plea, even if I completely fail to give it. He still has to show that that's going to likely result in his deportation. So is defense counsel, in your view, under Padilla, required to do more than the court is required to do?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And does defense counsel have to do more than the defendant would have to show, which is that the plea would likely result in deportation?
Yes, my red light has gone on. May I
answer that? And you,
thank you,
not stated anything perhaps you wanted to state, so let's give you about 4 minutes to do that, to answer the question, okay, please?
So, yes, defense counsel's role is far different than that of the court at the plea hearing. I mean, the idea is that the defendant will have that information ahead of time and be able to consider that information in deciding whether or not to accept a plea offer. So the court's advisal, as Justice Gableman noted, oftentimes you give that advisal and suddenly there's a flurry of confusion between defendant and his attorney because
they
haven't discussed
the
issue.
That's when it applies. It's usually more, at least it's been my experience, is more confusing for the person that Justice Gableman was referencing who was born and raised in Burnett County, and they're wondering, why are you telling me I could be deported? that's where they're like,
okay.
What's happening here? That's a little confusing for someone who,
mm-hmm.
Right? That's, I think, what his reference was. But anyway, I'm sorry.
No, I think to the contrary, by having defense counsel comply with their Padilla duty and bring this up and discern the law ahead of time, you will get plea agreements. You will get convictions that are more secure. You will get less post-conviction motions being brought when non-citizen defendants understand those consequences and know what's going to happen.
Counsel, what should the defense counsel have said in this case to fit Padilla?
In this case, defense counsel should have said, this is a drug trafficking conviction. It's an aggravated felony under the immigration laws. A conviction for an aggravated felony will bar you absolutely from any discretionary relief under the law. And the immigration judge, when you see the immigration judge, he or she will have no discretion but will enter an order of removal against you. That is 100% certain. What I mentioned in my brief and you referenced earlier, there are two mandatory situations where an immigration judge can't deport someone, and that is if the person can prove that they will be tortured in their home country. So we have international obligations that prohibit us from deporting someone if they will be tortured on removal. But absent that, that person will be deported.
Do you think a detainer under the Act is only issued, I'm just looking at the language of 8 CFR 287.7 and how this works as far as issuing a detainer. A detainer doesn't mean you're being deported. A detainer means when this law enforcement agency is going to release you, we want a heads up because we may choose to take you into custody. A detainer by no means is a deportation action. a detainer also, I don't think, is contingent upon someone having entered a plea. A detainer could be issued for any person who is not legally in the country, right?
Correct. So if when a person is processed, they're fingerprinted, that information is shared with federal law enforcement, including ICE. ICE gets that information and they say, for whatever reason, we think this person might be deportable, might be removable.
But the issuance
so they
of
issue
a detainer doesn't mean that they'll even take them into custody. It just
Correct.
Means give me a heads up because I have to decide, and I'll give me 48 hours. I don't need forever.
Correct.
But I want 48 hours. When you're going to release this person, I want a chance to decide if I want
Correct.
To pick them up. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So a detainer is by no means contingent on a plea.
Right.
Nor is it contingent upon someone serving a sentence or even having been sentenced, right?
Right.
And what you have in this case is a detainer that was issued.
In Shatta, yes.
Okay.
Yes. And you have his testimony that he had a hearing either scheduled, I think he said he had a hearing coming up with an immigration judge.
Is this case on all fours with Padilla, factually?
This case is yes, but in Padilla, we know for a fact that Mr. Padilla was a lawful permanent resident. As I mentioned in my brief, in this case, we don't actually know what Mr. Shatta's status was at the time of this, at the time of his plea. Whether he was a lawful permanent resident, whether he was here unlawfully, we don't actually know that. The conviction itself is absolutely on all fours. It's a drug trafficking felony, aggravated felony under the immigration law that absolutely results in the entry of a removal order.
Does it matter what his status is?
It matters in terms of what defense counsel's duty during plea negotiations would have been. So if defense counsel had done his research and said, okay, this is an aggravated felony, what can we do to mitigate this? Well, perhaps he could have pled to simple possession of marijuana, which doesn't carry the same consequences. And again, and there it depends on what Mr. Shatta's status was, whether a simple possession of marijuana would have prevented his deportation, we don't know under the facts that we have.
If he was illegally within the country, it's not going to make any difference, right?
If he was unlawfully in the country.
And there was a detainer issued, and that was the part of the reason for it. It wouldn't matter which one he pled to, correct?
Well, it may still matter because, and again, this would depend on the negotiations between defense counsel and the prosecutor. A plea to simple possession of less than 30 grams of marijuana for personal use would not have barred Mr. Shatta from discretionary relief in front of the immigration judge.
Even if he was here unlawfully?
Correct, because he was married to a United States citizen. So on the basis of his marriage to a United States citizen, he could have obtained a waiver, a discretionary waiver, from the immigration judge had he pled to simple possession of less than 30 grams. And again, under the facts of this case, we don't know if that would have happened. We know that Mr. Shatta didn't have any other criminal history. He had a U.S. citizen wife, and I believe he had some children born here. We don't know what the prosecutor would have done.
What is this court supposed to do in terms of setting a standard that we can apply? We have another case coming. Seems to me the defense counsel ought to know what is defense counsel held to as a standard so that defense counsel is not accused of ineffective assistance of counsel and does right by the client, and the client does not have to bring a lawsuit to change the plea, withdraw the plea. So what does Padilla tell us, in your opinion, that is the standard that we have to enforce as a matter of federal constitutional law?
I think that Padilla requires that defense counsel undertake the research necessary to provide their client with an informed answer. And unlike what the state has said, I disagree. I think there that the answer is knowable. As they say in the X-Files, the truth is out there. And I think with some diligent research, there's no reason. Defense counsel are reasonably intelligent people. They're attorneys. They know where to look for the law. You start with a statute. You start with the Immigration and Nationality Act. You have Board of Immigration Appeals precedent decisions. Then you have the Seventh Circuit, and you have the Supreme Court.
Okay, so the defense counsel did the research, undertook it, now is going to provide the client with an informed answer. What should defense counsel have said in this case, in your opinion?
In the case of Mr. Shatta?
Yes.
Defense counsel should have said, if you plead guilty to illicit trafficking in a controlled substance, in this case marijuana, that is an aggravated felony under the immigration law, and you will be barred from any discretionary relief under the immigration laws, and the immigration judge will enter an order of removal against you. Will enter an order of removal against you. The judge will have no discretion but will have to enter that order.
Well, suppose that was wrong. Well, the judge has a little discretion, could have done something. So defendant is advised like this, and defense counsel then goes to trial. No harm, no foul, right? I don't mean defense counsel. Defendant goes to
Correct.
Trial. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Defense counsel is so advised and then decides, well, I'll take my chances anyway, and I'm going to plead. It's a good plea, and I'm going to take the deal, right? Then finds out the defense counsel was right. What can the defendant do?
Well, if defense counsel was correct in what they advised the defendant, then the defendant has been correctly advised, right? The problem comes when defense counsel wasn't right. And again, if defense counsel, well, yes.
Isn't that sort of a setup, though, for a plea not to be knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily entered into? When you have defense counsel saying, you're going to be deported if you plead, and you have the court saying, I need to advise you, you may face deportation, exclusion of admission, or denial naturalization. I mean, wouldn't that just be a setup for the defendant to later say, hey, you know what? The court told me may. I believe the court. I mean, it's a judge, and I'm going to believe what the judge says, not what you say. I mean, when you've got conflicting information being given, it seems like what you're asking is, even though the court has to give one thing, I mean, I get Padilla because defense counsel said, hey, no risk, zero. You're fine, enter a plea, no problem. And that wasn't the case. That is directly conflicting with what a court is saying. But when you have defense counsel saying, absolutely, you are going to be deported, and then you have a judge saying, hey, I need to advise you, you may be deported. Isn't that a setup for someone to say, yeah, I really didn't think you knew what you were talking about? I mean, we have the judge saying something different. Why shouldn't it be consistent? That's my question. That's the bottom line. Why shouldn't we just make it consistent? Make sure they know what the plea questionnaire says. Make sure they know what the plea says. Make sure they may be deported. And make sure the judge says you may be deported. Then there's really no question. The person knows I may be deported. Why shouldn't that be the answer?
Right. Well, I think that the burden is on defense counsel to prepare their client for that plea colloquy, and they go over the plea form with them and say, this is what you can expect. This is what the judge is going to say. That's separate.
Really listen to the judge because they don't know what they're talking
about.
Well,
no, but the judge isn't telling you wrong. The judge is just saying this may happen. I mean, I think that what the warnings do now is sort of flag it and say, you know what? And this seems to be what happened in Mr. Shatta's case, that it came up right there during the hearing, and counsel said, I don't know, So they took a break, 15-minute break, and came back, and Mr. Shatta entered the plea. I mean, I think, to me, that says that the attorney clearly didn't do their due diligence ahead of time. They didn't research, he didn't research those issues ahead of time. Now, should the plea form be changed? Should the statute be changed to be consistent with Padilla? I mean, that's a valid question.
Should we try to interpret it consistent?
I don't think you can, because I think Padilla says that you have to give the you have to give a clear warning. You have to advise your client specifically. A general warning that you might be deported is not enough. And Padilla also clearly says it doesn't. It's not limited to affirmative misadvice. It's an affirmative duty to research and to give your client specific, accurate information.
Thank you.
The statute preceded Padilla, right?
Correct. That's another point.
The statute may have been perfectly valid when passed, but Padilla raises questions about whether it's always appropriate under Padilla to give that advice by the court.
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Clerk? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Pizarro, representing Haran Shatta.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Amelia Bizarro, and I represent Hatim Shatta. I heard a lot of the questions you've asked both the amicus and the state, and I'll try to respond with them. Most recently, Justice Ziegler's question has been fresh in my mind about the duty of the court versus counsel's duty. And I think the difference there is the roles. You know, the court has a duty sort of to the process and to fairness, and I think to set sort of the floor. Counsel's duty, of course, is to the client and to their interests and to zealously represent them and advocate for them and, I think, accurately inform them so that they can make a knowing and voluntary decision to enter a plea. And so, to me, that is the difference, that counsel's duty to the client requires them to provide accurate information in line with the statute. To me, the advice here should have been, I've looked at the statute, which we know defense counsel did not do, so that would have been first, and to say, the statute says you shall be deported. I take that to mean you're going to be deported. If you enter this plea, I think that's what will happen. And if you want any further information, you should seek an immigration lawyer. I don't think defense counsel, in helping a client to make an accurate or a knowing decision, an intelligent decision about whether to enter a plea, has to transform into an immigration lawyer. I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I certainly don't want to be an immigration lawyer.
Well, isn't that proposal exactly what was in the concurrence in Alito? And that's a concurrence. That's two justices. It's not a majority. I think that you can read the majority as eschewing that proposal, because it is the majority, and that proposal comes in the concurrence. That is, refer to an immigration lawyer.
Well, I think that what Padilla requires, and I don't mean to suggest anything otherwise, is that in cases like this, or involved a drug conviction, it's very clear that you will be subject to, you will be deported. And so I think that that's the clear advice that counsel is required to give. I think that's sort of it. You know, immigration law being referred to as a rabbit hole and all these different paths and tunnels, you know, that's not what defense counsel has to do when representing their client. What they have to do is say, statute says, shall be removed if you are convicted, and you, client, have to decide for yourself what matters most. Is it, I don't want to be deported, that is so important to me, and as the courts have long held, deportation is a severe consequence and more severe than anything, and so I'm going to risk the trial and I'm going to risk a longer sentence, or is it that prison value is the most valuable to you and I want my attorney to get me the lowest possible sentence, even if that means I will be deported.
Seems to me this. that if an attorney is uncertain of the law, what's the attorney's responsibility? Number one, they should look at the law. I remember as a very young attorney out of law school being told, first thing you do is you look at the statute. Look at the law, right? I mean, this doesn't take 3 years to learn that, or shouldn't take 3 years. You look at the law. And then I think an attorney's obligation under the code of conduct, the ABA standards, is to do reasonable research. And I think the attorney's obligation under law and under professional reasonableness is to give accurate advice. That's why you have an attorney, right? But this doesn't seem to me to be phenomenally a new idea. I mean, I think this is, what do you do as an attorney? For heaven's sake, look at the statute. If you're not sure, do reasonable research, or do research as is reasonable, right? And then you have an obligation to give a client what you believe to be accurate advice, or to give accurate advice. That might be different, and you might have to refine that. But, you know, that's true no matter what kind of case you're dealing with. So what makes this different?
I don't think it does. I don't think this is that complicated. We start with the premise, as the court said, is that you look it up. And we know defense counsel didn't look it up. And if you, and I think I mentioned in my brief, truly, if you Google immigration consequences drug conviction, the answer is readily apparent and instantly provided.
So you do your research on Google rather than other...
You know, I tend to start with Googling it. And then, yeah, you move to the statute, because when I Google it, I'm pointed to where I should look next. So I do have a reputation for Googling a little too much. But I think, you know, here we have an attorney that said, it's super important to my client. It's the issue he's most concerned about. And everybody said chance, possibility, potential. And then at post-conviction, it became strong chance. And the problem, I think, either with chance or strong chance, is that it leaves open the possibility that there could be some other relief. And here, there isn't, because the statute says shall be removed.
Could I ask, are you saying that any time a defendant is charged with a controlled substance violation, except personal possession of less than 30 grams, I guess it is, that there has to be an advice that you will be deported? Now let me ask this. Are there different kinds of people who are eligible for deportation? Some are undocumented completely. Some have green cards. Let's say someone had a green card and they were working in Colorado and they were employed by a company that lawfully sells marijuana. Are they gone like that?
I think that probably depends on where the crime occurred. I mean, in Wisconsin, a guy who works for a company that legally sells marijuana can't legally do that here. So, yes, he would be gone.
So I thought you said that everybody who sells a controlled substance is going to be deported, period.
That's how I interpreted that. Anything other than possession for personal use for less than 30 grams of marijuana is subject to this mandatory deportation. And I guess I don't know what happens if, you know, marijuana becomes legal in Wisconsin and it's not a crime to sell it. I guess.
Well, that's because it's still a crime federally. That's the answer. That's why the federal law doesn't make
the distinction.
Right?
Right.
I mean, whether it's legal in Colorado does not affect whether it's legal federally.
Yes, and I think a person charged and convicted would be subject to the deportation. It really is only the, if I read the statute, most trivial possession of marijuana for personal use. Absent that, once brought before the immigration judge, and Shada told the court at the post-conviction hearing, I have this hearing, you know, I think then that there is no discretion. There is an order for removal.
Well, let me ask another hypothetical. I see a young lady in red. You're representing her, and you're representing the lady with the white sweater right over there. The lady in red, let's say, has 45 grams of marijuana, and she's caught at that and charged with possession?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the lady over here, she imported 12 pounds of cocaine and has a history of selling. Are you saying that Padilla says that you must give exactly the same advice to both of them, and that is you're going to be deported?
Yes. If you were convicted either of distributing tons of cocaine or possessing 45 grams or more, you will be deported. Now, I think that's essential for counsel to know, right? Because my chances in representing her of getting a negotiated resolution of something under 30 grams is much more possible, and would then, if I'm able to do that, allow her to stay in the country versus her, where we're sort of having a lot more problems. So I think, you know, and so knowing that, I think, is essential then to being able to represent the client. But I think, yes, the deportation is the same.
But, counsel, we were told by the counsel who preceded you that if Mr. Shada had negotiated a different resolution to plead to a charge of under 30 grams for personal use, that ordinarily he would be subject to deportation. He would be deported. I made the same mistake you caught yourself from saying at the beginning, subject to deportation. That he would be, but for the fact that he was married to a United States citizen. Now, it seems to me that your bright line test requires the defense counsel to know all things. You want to draw the distinction that all the lawyer has to say is, you will be deported. But on the other hand, in the same breath, you say, I'm not an immigration lawyer, I never want to be an immigration lawyer, and I don't know the fine detail. I just learned, for instance, that if you're married to a United States citizen, that saves you from being deported. So I like the clarity of your bright line rule. I'm just not sure it's workable.
I think, for me, Judge, the opposite becomes more unworkable, because then I think we start talking about degrees. If strong chance is enough, what about good chance? If I tell a client you're more likely than not, I think that...
Why not just say what you started to say and the word that I actually said, which is, hey, if you plead to this, you're subject to deportation. None of us in this room, and I'm speaking in a hypothetical courtroom, none of us in this room are immigration experts, and we don't know. We don't know how presidential policy, how attorney general policy, we don't know what the ICE officers may want to extract from you in exchange for staying in this country. But, you know, we're going to follow a rule where we're just going to tell you that you're going to be deported. And that seems to me to either require an impossibility on the part of the attorney and the trial court judge. And I think there must be a good reason why the trial court judge is required to advise it is possible that you will be deported, excluded, or refused readmission. Go ahead.
I think that Padilla changed that, though. I mean, what Padilla is, if that were okay, then we wouldn't have Padilla. But what Padilla has said is where the immigration consequences are clear, the advice must be clear. So me telling my client You shall be deported if you're facing what Mr.
But
Shada...
But that's the opposite of Padilla. The lawyer in Padilla said, you won't be deported.
Right. And what Padilla also says is that we're not limiting our decision to affirmative misadvice, because to do so would create two absurd results. It would encourage counsel to remain silent, and it would prevent help to people who most need it. And so it's not okay to say, I don't know, you know, you're on your own, or if someone says, what will happen to me, for me to change the subject.
Let me just cut to the chase. Doesn't it most accurately reflect reality of the 71 courthouses across our state? Doesn't it most reflect reality to expect the defense lawyers and the judges, I say 71 because, as we all know, Menominee County doesn't have them. Doesn't it most accurately reflect reality for the counsel to say, this may result in your deportation?
I don't think it does when it comes to a drug trafficking offense like this one or an aggravated felony, because in those two clear classifications listed in Section 1227, it says shall be deported.
Upon the order of the Attorney General.
And, Judge, I would like to ask if we can provide supplemental authority on that point, if you would like, because I do think that sort of connect, that bridge that you're looking for from Attorney General to immigration judge, I believe that authority exists, and if it does, I would like to be able to provide it, if that would help clarify the issue.
We'll discuss it in conference.
But because I think that, so that's what I think, pretty, you know, here it's clear, you shall be deported. I have to tell you, you shall be deported. I don't, you know, in other jurisdictions have said it's not enough to say possible chance. You know, there are, as the state's brief pointed out, sort of a split on what is enough. But I think here, you know, there's simply no question that this was Mr. Shada's primary concern. There's also no question that counsel didn't look it up.
Well, what happens in the case where a lawyer in one of our counties is representing a client who is not a citizen, and that client is charged and is going to plead out to the under 30 grams for personal possession? Now, as that lawyer, would we impose, it seems to me a natural extension of what you're saying is, the lawyer would have to say, you're going to be deported. But we know now that that's not true if they're married to a United States citizen. So we are, it seems to me, we're getting closer and closer to requiring our defense counsel to also be immigration lawyers.
I think the focus should be on that decision to enter a plea. And if I look at the statute and I accurately convey to my client what that statute says, and here it says, over, you have, client, you have over 30 grams, you out.
My hypothetical is under 30 grams for personal possession.
Well, if it's under 30,
use.
Under 30 grams, then it would not be subject to the section that requires it to be that he shall be deported.
I thought,
but might he be deported?
And I don't know, and I don't think I have to know the answer to that question. If my client has less than 30 grams of marijuana and it's for personal use, then there's no
mandatory provision, right?
Correct. And so I
maybe something else in the statute that might make him deportable or deported. Right?
Yes.
And discretion might be exercised any number of things, including whether he's married to an American citizen. But there might be discretion for other reasons, too, namely that his children are American citizens.
Right.
There are various grounds for discretion, if I understand this.
I think so.
Under the circumstances where it's less than 30.
Yes.
But if it's over 30, your position is it falls under this statute, and it's mandatory deportation. And that's what the defense counsel had to advise the defendant. And strong chance was not good enough.
Correct. And I think when it comes to prejudice, then the question is whether or not the defendant would have made a rational decision to reject the offer. And to me, this is more than strength of the state's case. And it looks at other considerations. And the brief, I referenced cases in which the court found that it was rational to reject a plea when the deal was for a year and the maximum possible sentence was life. Here we have a maximum possible sentence of 10 years, a client with no prior convictions, you know, and a defendant who made statements both, I think, at sentencing and the post-conviction hearing about the case, such that he, you know, it wasn't as an automatic, straightforward, there's no rational person who would ever reject this deal. I mean, certainly, if Mr. Shada's concerns about deportation outweighed his fear of prison, and I think that was clear in the testimony, he said that it was his number one concern, then it would be rational for him to reject that deal, to go to trial and try. And if he failed, he would be convicted, he would be sentenced, probably to a higher sentence than he received, and he would be deported at the end of it.
Counsel, if we buy your argument, does it set up a subsequent claim when some prosecutors say, hey, I'm not offering your guy a plea. He's got no defense. I'm taking him to trial. It's going to take me about a half a day to do this, and we're done. Are you setting up then an equal protection argument that folks that may have or do have, as you say, immigration consequences will be treated differently than those who don't have set potential consequences in the justice system?
I don't think so, because I think the government is treating everybody the same, right? They're saying whether the fact that you're an immigrant isn't the reason why I'm, not offering a deal. It's the strength of the case or, case-specific circumstances.
Well, I think that there are often times when a prosecutor will still offer a plea when the prosecutor's got a great case. For a variety of reasons, our system would almost collapse if we didn't have plea bargaining. But if they began to pick up on this and just said, you know what, I can never tell if defense counsel does it exactly right, and even if he does, I can't really tell if the defendant really, really understood what he was saying or was just hearing he might get probation rather than jail time. So I'm not doing these anymore. If you've got immigration consequences, I'm not doing it. I'm going to trial. Why would I bother with this? I've got to even admit he did it. There was identified on a video. I don't know. Isn't that the next case that'll come when someone would have liked to have had an opportunity to plea and just simply was never offered it?
Well, I think in every case, the defendant can always inform the court, I wish to plead. I'm asking, the state to waive the right to jury trial.
He only gets to plead if the prosecutor offers him. He can plead guilty to every single thing that's there.
Right.
That's not generally the case.
No.
Right.
I mean, I think that, I guess it's hard to know what will happen next. But I don't think that exercising prosecutorial discretion and saying, plea or trial, I don't think that is going to set up an equal protection claim.
But there were cases that say you're not entitled to plea agreements, that if the prosecutor offers it, okay, you can take it or leave it or negotiate, but that you can't force a prosecutor to.
I was just talking about treating two people differently based on their class. This foundational different treatment.
Well, they are different. The people are different if they're American citizens, not subject to deportation. Or if they're not American citizens and are subject to deportation, you can treat people differently if they are different. Are they different?
All right, go ahead, Justice. Are they different?
Yeah. As an American citizen who pleads to a drug crime, in a different position than an undocumented alien who pleads to a drug crime. Aren't they different under the law?
Yes.
Okay, so you can treat them differently, right?
Yes.
As long as there's
a rational basis for the
treatment. Yes.
Right? Okay. Why is the paradigm accept this plea or go to trial? What happens with, on occasion, and maybe more than occasionally, is that a plea offer is made, but subsequently it's altered and a different kind of plea is made. The test, I thought, is whether a rational person, defendant, would accept the plea. I mean, even the Padilla case indicates under those facts that there were other kind of charges unrelated to the charge of drugs, that they could have pled to those other charges, hypothetically. As time approaches, getting very close to trial, it's not unusual for a prosecutor to see the case a little differently, knowing that the main witnesses is in Utah visiting his granddaughter, you know. And so I'm not sure the paradigm is accept this plea or go to trial. Am I right or wrong? Help me with clarifying that.
I think the end result is sort of the conviction, so I think you're right. But I think, you know, knowing your client's primary concern then fuels the steps that counsel takes next. So, and like you said, we're saying, well, if you get deported, if you're convicted, you'll be deported, and the client says, well, that's the most important thing to me, then that fuels how you negotiate or don't negotiate. And I think, like you just said, sort of counter-offering and negotiating and advocating for your client. But I think, you know, ultimately there are just two choices. Either the person is convicted after a plea or they're convicted after a trial. That makes them subject to Section 1227.
Well, and in this case, the defendant made a motion to adjourn the trial. The court denied that motion, and he entered a plea. So this really isn't one of those where, you know, it was go to trial or plea.
Right. And I think at that hearing, what we heard counsel say is, I need a little more time. I'm trying to figure out immigration. And then the sort of some things happened that the court said, well, it looks like today is the day. And they took a break to kind of see if they could work it out and ended up entering that plea that day. So I think that's correct, Justice Siegler.
Could I ask, when does the government commence deportation? In this case, defendant was sentenced to a year of incarceration, and then I think 4 years of extended supervision. Okay. If he had made no motions, when would the deportation start?
My understanding is the way that it works is that, and this is a basic understanding, the conviction gets reported to Homeland Security. If the client is incarcerated, the detainer that Justice Siegler referenced is issued. If he is not incarcerated, he gets a notice to appear. And I think that is that part of the record that he tried to provide to the post-conviction court. And then they go to a hearing. So the conviction occurs first, and then it's somehow reported, and Homeland takes a look at it and says, oh, this is, we think this might be it, and process is started that way.
So if someone is put on probation right off the bat and no jail time, it could start almost immediately?
I guess I don't want to speak to time because I truly don't know how long it takes, but yes, I think upon entry of the conviction, even while the person is on probation, I think in Mendez that's what happened. He was convicted, he was on probation, and then officers sort of knocked on the door while he was successfully serving his term of probation. So I think that it can happen relatively quickly, but I'm not certain as to the exact time frame.
Can they pull him out of prison here?
I think that
service.
I don't know if they pull him out of. I think the detainer is issued, and when the sentence is complete, they're taken into custody, you know, immigration custody, and sometimes might even stay in the same jail, but or go to the one where there is the contract. But they're not. The person isn't released. It's my understanding. I think that in terms of prejudice, that a defendant need not demonstrate that he's already been ordered removed for there to be prejudice. I think it's enough, like Mr. Shah, to hear both his testimony that there's a proceeding in the future or that proceedings have been started for there to be, for the prejudice analysis to be enough. I think that it would be unworkable for it first to require an order of removal before a person can demonstrate prejudice.
Would it evade review? In other words, once an order is issued, I would imagine at times it's done real quickly.
I think it would evade review, and I think it would be contrary to sort of the post-conviction and direct appeal procedure that we have in play, particularly in a case where a defendant is sentenced to a term of prison. If it's anything more than a year, the direct appeal process would have had to have been started before you got your removal order. So I think that it would cause all sorts of problems. Ultimately here, I'm asking the court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision. And I think that the reasoning, both on deficient performance and prejudice, is sound. It's in line with Padilla, and Padilla controls this case.
What about remanding?
I think that it was sufficient in the Court of Appeals decision, I think, stands on its own. I think in the brief I said, you know, if the court must reverse and remand, then there definitely should be a hearing to further assess the situation on the prejudice prong. But I think that the record is sufficient, and I think the Court of Appeals decision should be affirmed on its face.
If that happens, then what happens?
If that happens, then Mr. Shada's conviction is vacated, and he's put back in the position he was in before he entered his plea in the circuit court. And so he will be facing the same charge, and he will be facing a very difficult decision about whether or not to proceed to trial, or, of course, whether or not any new negotiations can occur in light of the year of prison that he already served, something that would be that would take him out of sort of the mandatory order of removal.
Do we know where he is?
I have been in contact with him electronically. I believe I know where he is, but it's not something that we've talked about generally.
Okay.
My red light is on. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Millett.
Attorney Bizarro, excuse me, said it well. I am not an immigration attorney, and I don't want to be one. And I will add to that, she shouldn't have to be. Because if she is, it asks way too much. A lot of the branches of the rabbit hole I referenced in terms of immigration law showed their face during her remarks and the court's questions. What is Mr. Shada's status? His attorney doesn't know. He might not know. But it will matter to the analysis of what a conviction will mean for him in terms of the immigration consequences to follow? Yes, it does. Another little branch I'll throw out there just to demonstrate how the morass that is this field of law can be very troubling. There are countries, one of them, I believe, is Laos, that do not take their citizens back when they are deported under these circumstances, and so they can't be deported. Is that something we are going to expect criminal defense attorneys to know? And if they should, and the court adopts the proposition from opposing counsel that the standard ought to be, they are required to tell defendants convicted of certain offenses, certainly the one here, you will be deported, that's wrong.
No. Go ahead. Counsel, I understand that argument. I understand that there are different ways of approaching Padilla. But you lost that argument in Padilla. Even Alito, in his concurrence, when he summarizes the Padilla majority, says the court nevertheless holds a criminal defense attorney must provide advice in this specialized area. And those cases in which must provide advice in this specialized area, and those cases in which the law is succinct and straightforward. And the majority, of course, held that the federal statute here is succinct and straightforward. So your argument lost in Padilla.
But the question remains, because Padilla didn't answer and did not say, what exactly does a defense attorney have to say? They use the phrase succinct, clear, and explicit, and say, when the law is such, you know, the duty to give correct advice in those circumstances is equally clear, but they don't say what that means.
Yeah, but I heard you playing off attorney defense counsel's position, Ms. Bizarro, that, well, I'm not an immigration lawyer. And I say, well, let's look at what the United States Supreme Court said in its majority opinion in Padilla, and as characterized actually in both the concurrence and the dissent. But I'm reading the concurrence right now. It says that. It says, hey, your argument that I'm not an immigration lawyer doesn't hold weight. The court, according to Alito, the majority nevertheless holds that a criminal defense attorney must provide that advice.
The majority also says the proper measure of attorney performance remains simply reasonableness under prevailing professional norms. And they acknowledge immigration law is complex, and in footnote 10, the majority says, lack of clarity in the law, however, does not obviate the need for counsel to say something about the possibility of deportation, even though it will affect the scope and nature of counsel's advice.
That's right. And they were dealing then with what they considered something other than the clear and succinct, but from what you
understood. And, yeah.
But you see, so this argument that, hey, I'm not an immigration lawyer, I'm going to wash my hands of it, was heard, was advanced, and was rejected by precedent that we're bound by.
Oh, and so, don't misunderstand me. I'm not advocating that as a standard
but
here.
But I think what you said, is, for me, is quite interesting. And it was a part of the subject of our prior exchange. And that is, it seems to me, you're saying, based on also, of course, what Padilla said, the standard is reasonableness, right? The reasonableness standard of the profession. Is it reasonable for the attorney here not to have read the statute?
I think his testimony was he hadn't read it in terms of whether deportation would be mandatory. That said, you know, counsel takes trial counsel to task. Well, you know, he called some colleagues who do this kind of work. Boy, if that's deficient performance, I'm going to have to go report to OLR because I do it all the time. That said, even if you think the trial counsel in this case didn't do enough in terms of research or otherwise, and I agree there certainly is an applicable standard there, he got it right. He was right. He told his client there's a strong chance you could be deported, and I think he was right about that, and it's right under Padilla. And my red light is now on. But.
Well, as I read Padilla, and this is the one, two, fourth full paragraph, we agree, this is Stevens, with Padilla, that constitutionally competent counsel would have advised him that his conviction for drug distribution made him subject to automatic deportation. That's what Padilla says the attorney should have done there. Now, if I assume that we have the same kind of offense here under the same statute, then it seems to me the law is the same in that it is automatic deportation, and that what the lawyer should have done here is what Padilla says, advise him that conviction for drug distribution made him subject to automatic deportation. What's the matter with that reasoning?
Well, I think it's wrong. I don't think there is any such thing as automatic deportation. It's dicta, and the court, in the majority's opinion, they talk about becoming eligible for deportation. They speak of presumptively mandatory, and that's where they hit it most heavily in terms of, you know, if you're going to put a label on this. The automatic deportation language is dicta. It's wrong, and it's an unfortunate choice of words.
Well, the dissent, you've got Scalia taking the majority to task towards the end of his dissent, saying,
acknowledging this is, although he qualifies it, nearly automatic. I mean, he sees it the same way, other than he does qualify it. So it isn't just the majority that's referring to these statutes as automatic. The dissent also refers to this statute as being nearly automatic. It says at the very end, federal immigration law might provide, for example, that the near automatic removal, which follows from certain criminal convictions, will not apply. They're coming up with, you know, new alternatives. He characterizes this as near automatic removal, so it is just the majority.
Strong chance, near automatic removal. I think that's the question. What's good enough here? Even the Supreme Court in that decision alone struggled and fell all over themselves trying to figure out exactly how to say it right. And there are inconsistencies there in the language, which is precisely why I strongly advocate that this court not put in play any sort of standard that would require magic words or specific language to be used by criminal defense attorneys in these cases, because it doesn't work. We have Strickland, we have the duties counsel has in terms of knowing the law, but don't go too far, because every case is going to be different. And if you get down that rabbit hole, who is he married to, a U.S. citizen or not? Is he a lawful permanent resident? Is he unlawfully here? How long has he been here? Does he have family here? Does he not? Does he face persecution if he leaves the country? Does he not? Does he claim that? Does he have any defense against the church? There's so many things in play here. If you ask too much of criminal defense attorneys, it goes too far. It isn't what we want for defendants to know, have a realistic, realistic idea about what they face. And again, I go back to the sentencing analogy. You could get the maximum. We are asking for less. The DA might be. But so you know, the judge could give you the maximum. That's good enough in terms of sentencing. The defense attorney doesn't have to say, you will get, you're subject to a maximum penalty of 25 years. I'm going to tell you now, you're going to get 10 years and 60 days.
No, Chief, if I may. You're setting up straw men to knock down. No one wants magic words. You know, like, this is a specter. You know, of course no one wants magic words. No one wants that the defense attorney is going to say, I guarantee that you will get 10 years. And no one wants that. That's just a straw man you're setting up to knock down. It seems to me, though, what most defendants want in order to make an informed decision, the attorney can say, okay, maximum penalty is 25 years, and fine $10,000. But most, in order to make a formed decision, they want to know, yeah, but what about here? No guarantees. And, of course, defense attorneys are going to constantly say, no guarantees, no guarantees. But, I mean, is it too far for the defense attorney to say in a case where there's no prior conviction, there's no prior record, you've got strong family ties and you've got a business and stuff, that likely the judge isn't going to be giving you the maximum. I mean, it's more than just telling maximums and, in some cases, minimums. You want a lawyer to advise you more than that, don't you?
You do, and sometimes they can because of, again, their experience with a specific charge, with a specific judge, et cetera. Sometimes they can't. What about the new lawyer?
Fair enough. Fair enough.
And I, what I'm asking is not to go, defense counsel or opposing counsel is asking for, he should have been told, you will be deported. And I don't think anyone can say that, ever. Strong chance and things
like that. Might die, you know, but other than that, you'll be deported.
I'm sorry?
I said they might die, but other than that, the majority seems to say that they will be deported under this statute if it is a, if there's a conviction.
It is very likely, highly likely, strong. I think that there's probably, as a practical matter, you're going to go. Mr. Shada, by the way, knew that, and this is what we want him to know, what he faced. This is a man who, in an effort to avoid conviction here, because he knew deportation was likely coming, somehow managed to go to a police officer's home in an effort to cooperate and work, and have the charges somehow reduced. I don't know how he managed to do that, but he did. He didn't do that because he had any misunderstanding about the possibility of his deportation. He knew he did that because he knew. That's why there were so many discussions on the record about deportation and otherwise. And I think these are things that we have to consider, absolutely, in terms of whether defense counsel has met his or her obligation in these cases. And we can't go further and put labels or require certain, you know, language to be used. And it certainly shouldn't be, you will be deported, because it's not right.
Justice Prosser.
You would like the Court of Appeals decision to be reversed.
Yes.
And if it were reversed, it seems to me opposing counsel might want to take this to the United States Supreme Court. So the point is that if the court sides with you, it is, in effect, writing for the United States Supreme Court. How do you address them about the Padilla opinion? What do you say about it? Because, I mean, there's some pretty strong words about give the correct advice, clear. I mean, don't you have to say you were just too ambiguous for us to follow? Or what do you say?
I don't think defense or trial counsel's advice in this case failed to comply with Padilla. I think it was good enough under Padilla. Padilla doesn't require specific language. Again, they lay out in that decision, you know, the obligation of attorneys, and again, referencing Strickland and what is reasonable under the circumstances. I think in the end, you know, we can debate about whether Attorney Turan, I believe he was defense counsel or trial counsel, I'm not trying to call him out unfairly, but I know him, and it's just a little easier to use his name, whether he should have done more than call a few people and read the statute or whatnot. In the end, he would have come to the same conclusion he did. There was a very good chance, a strong chance, that his client would be deported, and his client knew that. He communicated it to him. It's good enough under Padilla. That's what Padilla demands, and that's what happened.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. And I want to thank both defense counsel, prosecution, and the amicus counsel for their arguments in the state v. Shada on our first impression about the application of the Padilla case. That ends our hearing on 13 AP 1437 CR, State v. Shada. And we'll take a few minutes in recess so the students can leave if they wish to. And a different group of students will come in. We will then reconvene and hear the first part of the arguments in the next case, which has, as you know, a related issue to this.